You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On October the 8th, the CBC is going to broadcast an environmental debate. In a recent poll, 71% of Canadians said they wanted to hear what the leaders had to say about their plans to protect the environment. But the chances are low of hearing any promises that would make much of a dent in Canada's greenhouse gas production, according to Ian Angus. He's editor of the online journal Climate and Capitalism, and Ian Angus joins me today from Ontario. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Jane.
So what actions have the Conservatives taken on climate change since they came into power?
Well, as you know, when the Conservatives were elected, they were pretty much in denial mode. There was no climate change problem. And the first thing they did in office was to cancel 9 or 10 programs that the Liberals had created. Now, they weren't particularly profound programs, but the fact that the Tories thought the right thing to do was nothing became very apparent. Well, over the next year, global warming suddenly moved into the headlines and huge shift in public opinion, and the Tories decided this was something that they couldn't avoid. During 2007, the Tories introduced a number of things that what they called the Turning the Corner Plan, which basically involved focusing on efficiency, how well we use fossil fuels. The plan really didn't amount to much. The British Tyndall Institute analyzed it and concluded that if there was no Tory plan, the emissions would be exactly the same over the next decade and perhaps even a little bit lower. The way the plan was structured, the tar sands could triple their emissions and still meet the targets, which will give you some idea of just how good it was.
Have they changed their tune at all in their campaigning so far?
They really have. It's interesting. I think they've concluded that there is enough of a right-wing anti-ecology vote, or at least non-ecological vote, that they can pitch for. And in this campaign, perhaps the most noteworthy thing they've done in this respect is promising a 50% reduction in taxes on diesel and aviation fuel. Now, those are responsible for about 10% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions, and here the Conservatives are going to give $600 million to those industries.
That's a pretty whacking subsidy there.
It's pretty hefty, all right. But they're doing it as a method of countering the Liberals. They see, they think they can paint the Liberals as being, crazy in favor of taxes. And so they have pulled way, way back. And I think there's no question that if the Conservatives win this election, you'll see even more retreats, even from the rather limited programs they did.
And this is all in the name of economic growth?
Yes, and it's in the name of defend the economy, protect jobs, all the things that always seem to come up in this kind of context.
Now, the Liberals are proposing to bring in a carbon tax. What are the specifics on that?
Well, it's actually a fairly complex plan. It's 48 pages long, and that's just in the brochure version. But fundamentally, what the Liberals say they want to do is shift taxes away from income taxes and traditional corporate taxes and instead tax greenhouse gas emissions. Now, the actual amounts they're planning to impose are very, very small. They would not reach even $40 a ton until the fourth year of their implementation of their plan. But the idea is that they would start taxing emissions and reduce other taxes by the same amount.
So you kind
theory
of
theory here is that if people are if emissions are taxed, people will try and reduce their emissions.
Right. So you sort of shift the tax burden and what you tax.
That's right.
Now the NDP has said that carbon taxes are going to mean higher prices for working people, and they favor a cap and trade program. Can you just remind us of how that system works?
Well, a cap and trade program involves the government setting limits of some sort on the amount of emissions that either the entire economy or various industries or various corporations can make. And each corporation then has emissions credits, which, depending on whose plan you're looking at, are either given to them or sold or auctioned. And those would allow them to go up to the limit but no higher. And the idea is that a company that has a lot of trouble cutting its emissions could buy credits from companies that did very well at it. So if company A reduces its emissions a lot, it would then have some spare credits that it could sell to companies that didn't do so well at it. A related part of it involves not reducing emissions at all, but getting credits for example, investing in planting trees in India. and then those could be used as credits. So you don't have to reduce your emissions in Canada. You just do something off in some other country.
And why is the NDP behind this?
Well, I mean, I think there's a certain level of demagogy here, unfortunately. You know, the NDP often, they're taking a strong position that the carbon tax is going to raise costs for working people, and that's certainly true. The way the Liberal plan works, we'll see no effect on emissions very much because it's too low, but it will raise the cost of essentials, of, you know, food and transportation, housing, things like that. But the thing is that a cap-and-trade program is just an indirect way of doing the same thing. What you're doing is putting a price on emissions that someone has to pay. In the case of a tax, it goes directly on the consumer. In the case of cap-and-trade, it's the corporation that has to pay for the emissions it generates, and, of course, it'll pass those on to consumers anyway.
Have other regions had success with cap-and-trade?
Cap-and-trade hasn't worked anywhere on greenhouse gases. The main place where it's been tried has been in Europe, where there has been a cap-and-trade system in effect since 2005, and it's generally conceded to have been a complete disaster. A number of companies have made out like bandits on it because they, for example, in some of the electrical utilities in England were planning to close down high-emission coal-based electrical plants anyway, so now they closed them down and claimed the credits and sold those credits to other people. But if you look across Europe, there is no evidence whatsoever that cap-and-trade has had any effect on reducing emissions in Europe.
Let's look at the Greens and the Bloc. What are the Greens proposing?
Well, the Greens actually are proposing both a tax and a cap-and-trade. Their plan is for a cap-and-trade solution or a cap-and-trade system that would apply only to the largest emitters, the biggest corporations, and then a carbon tax that would apply on consumers. The Bloc is for cap and trade, but given their specific focus on Quebec rights, the Bloc's program just says cap and trade, but it would be done one province at a time. Each province would have its own program.
Is this what you've called putting a price, or what's been called putting a price on carbon? Is this approach going to work?
Not all by itself. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the idea of putting a price on carbon as part of a plan to reduce emissions. But when it's viewed as the solution in itself, and that's how all the parties are viewing it, all the parties that favor either taxes or cap and trade, it really is not going to do the job. I mean, the first thing is, if you look at a consumer, if you're an ordinary person, it says, okay, you're now going to have to pay a tax or something on all your gas and all your heating fuel and so on. But there aren't alternatives to that. There's not, you know, a great free transit system that I can switch to. There's the houses that are built that don't retain heat well, they're still there. And so from a consumer's point of view, it's just an increased cost because there really is not an alternative you can switch to. From a corporate point of view, the theory of putting a price on carbon says that, you know, because corporations will want to reduce their costs, they'll see this price on carbon and they'll try and reduce that. Well, the difficulty is that if you look at what's happened in the real world in the past even century or 10 years or whatever category you want to, when corporations have their prices go up because of taxes or because of other government activities, they typically find there's a lot of things they would rather do than change the fundamental ways they do business, which using fossil fuels a lot is fundamental to an awful lot of Canadian businesses. So they lobby and push the government for exemptions. We've already seen the Liberals back off on parts of their plan because of heavy lobbying. Or they literally cheat and lie. What most people don't realize is that when the government says, okay, we're going to limit emissions from, say, this refinery to this, everybody assumes that there's some actual measurement of emissions going on. But there isn't. What they really do is they have a formula for calculating a plant of this size with these activities and this amount of inputs will produce this amount of emissions. And that formula is what produces the reports that go into the government about Canadian emissions. Well, in the last couple of years, the technology to actually measure emissions has developed extremely well. And there was a report published just a month or two ago in which the researchers literally studied the actual emissions from an oil refinery in Alberta and compared them to the numbers that came out of the existing process. Well, it turned out that this plan was producing vastly more emissions using its in the real world than it was reporting using the standard method that the entire industry used. It was something like 19 times more benzene, 15 times more hydrocarbons, and 9 more times methane, methane being one of the worst of the greenhouse gases. And so this report came out, and the oil industry's reaction was not, oh, we've got to improve our formula. It was to demand that the government hide the numbers. Don't publish these tables that have the comparison of what we're reporting versus what we're really doing. And this has been the norm. As long as we depend on self-reporting by industries, if you look at, surely one experience, one lesson we've learned from the past 10 years is that, you think of Enron, telling the truth to on their reports to the government is not something they all specialize in.
I guess corporations that can would also have the possibility of moving somewhere where the pollution controls were not so stringent.
Yes, and that's another big component of this, is that facing restrictions, corporations will move their capital, either directly in the sense of this company now moves all of its production to Mexico or India or wherever, or indirectly in the sense that investors will say, we're not going to invest in this industry because we can't make as much profit in it. Perhaps we're making a profit, but not enough. So we will move it into either other industries that aren't as regulated or, as you say, into other countries.
Let's assume for a moment, big assumption here, that all these programs work the way that they were intended and that the corporations reported accurately and didn't move and stayed in Canada and changed their emissions. Would it be enough?
Not even close. And that's the other real problem with these programs, is that they basically focus our attention on things that can't do the job, even if they work exactly the way they're supposed to do. You know, the most ambitious published case for carbon taxes is a book called Hot Air, which came out in Canada about a year ago. And it proposed a very ambitious approach to putting a price on carbon in order to cut Canadian emissions. And it was very effectively argued. But in their most aggressive plan in that book, emissions were going to be cut by about 50% by 2050, and that's 50% from the 2010 level. Now, that's not nearly enough. No climate scientist thinks that's an adequate target. And despite that, none of the plans of Canadian politicians even come close to what the book proposed. So what we have is plans that, even if they work, will leave us with greenhouse gas emissions continuing to pose an incredible threat to the survival of species, the survival of the entire human race in many places. Critically dangerous climate change will continue if they work on these targets.
Now, you say that we need to declare a climate emergency. What do you mean by that?
I mean that what's needed is to come at this exactly the way you'd come at another emergency. I mean, if you want to think of a very simple historical example, when World War II broke out, the Canadian government didn't announce cap and trade or taxes in order to shift production into war production and all the things that were needed to support the military. They simply sat down the automobile industry and the oil industry and all the rest and said, okay, as of now, you are changing what you do, period. And what happened was that those industries were redirected and reorganized in a matter of a year or so. There were no lost jobs. In fact, there was an economic boom. And the entire direction of the economy turned on a dime. That can be done if the government is willing to do it. If we had a government that was committed to stopping climate change, it could make those changes on that basis.
How are politicians getting away with proposing solutions that are so far off the mark?
Well, first of all, of course, there's a continuing campaign to argue that this isn't really a very serious program. We see this in the media all the time, every time, or a very serious problem that perhaps scientists are still arguing among themselves, which they're not, about whether this is a problem. Global warming has dropped out of the top headlines in the media of late, so we don't have nearly as much public pressure. But I think overall the decisive thing is that the politicians right across the board place continuing business as usual as their priority, and the alternatives have not been well presented. I think the green movement has, in many ways, abstained from this. I mean, I think it's quite sad that a substantial part of the mainstream green movement, the best they can think of to do is applaud Dion's program, a program that's completely inadequate. So what's needed is a real movement to push the politicians. It isn't going to. I think change is not going to come through traditional political channels unless the politicians feel that this is an issue that if they don't act on, they can't get elected.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Ian.
Thank you, Jane.
I've been speaking with Ian Angus. He's editor of the online journal Climate and Capitalism, and you can read an article that he wrote about climate change and the political parties in the upcoming election campaign in the latest edition of Climate and Capitalism. You can find a link to the journal on our website at coopradio.org/redeye, and that article is coming out on Monday.